Hello and welcome to A Little Less Conversation, a podcast series on how Australia is addressing climate change as a function of our international development program. I'm Jessica McKenzie, Chief of Policy at the Australian Council for International Development, or ACFID.
And I'm Dermot O'Gorman, CEO of WWF Australia. This series is a special collaboration between WWF Australia, ACFID, and Goodwill Hunters.
Climate change is the stormy undercurrent to our daily lives. Here in Australia, but also in many of the countries we work in as development practitioners, in fact, there it's a loud and urgent drumbeat. To do development effectively, it is increasingly glaringly obvious that addressing climate change needs to be front and centre of all of our efforts.
To that end, we're holding up the microphone to those that are willing to take on the sometimes vexed challenge of speaking to Australia's climate change and development goals, where they intersect and where they deviate, as well as profiling innovative themes and ideas. We want to see how Australia is gearing up for action, with climate change being a central pillar to Australia's new international development policy. It's now about how to implement that ambition. And so we want to investigate choices that will shape Australia's credibility into the global climate space.
We can't talk about climate finance without talking about the Green Climate Fund, also known for short as the GCF. The GCF is the world's largest climate fund. Anchored in the Paris Agreement, it was conceptualized in 2015 and has a mandate to support developing countries with a grant-based model. It aims to boost transformative climate action through a country-owned partnership and use flexible finance investment expertise to do this.
There's been a number of questions of the GCF. You know, how are they moving money to priority places? And are they really fit for purpose? Australia has recently rejoined the Green Climate Fund after leaving in 2019. And so it's a really opportune time to be able to be learning more about the GCF. And to do that, we're very honoured to have Henry Gonzalez, the Deputy Executive Director of the GCF, here with us today. Henry, you've got a long history of and experience in sustainable development and impact investing, both in emerging markets and looking at political and economic development. Welcome to the podcast, Henry. Can you start by giving us a short definition of what climate finance is all about?
Sure. First of all, thank you very much, Jessica and Dermot, for inviting the Green Climate Fund to take part of this important podcast. Climate finance is at the center of today's development agenda. And we have indeed quite a broad climate finance architecture, where we have multilateral, bilateral, private sector, and civil society all coming together in order to see how we could deliver on that very ambitious but needed task of helping countries transition and building more resilient economies that are facing the climate impact. The Green Climate Fund was indeed, as Jessica mentioned, created with that in mind. We were created by the COP as part of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC. And we have been working since 2015 in trying to bring climate solutions across emerging and developing countries. Climate finance is the conduit of financial resources to support, in the case of GCF, mitigation and adaptation. Our mandate requires that we have an equilibrium between these two important areas. So we are focused in helping countries build more resilient societies that are helping the most vulnerable, but at the same time that we are helping the country in their net zero and also in the reduction of emissions. Now, we at the GCF have a unique value added, and that is that we work with a set of partners all around the world that have the same mission. And these partners come from governments, both at the regional, local, and federal level. It's also the civil society, both from foundations, from NGOs, and from activists, private sector, at the, you know, private sector, meaning local private sector or global private sector. And we are also able to work with the other multilateral development agencies, bilateral development banks, regional development banks, multilateral development banks. So we've got quite a set of players that we are able to work with. And what we try to do through those players is we try to deploy our sort of toolkit of financial solutions. And as Jessica said, we have done a lot in the grant space, but we've also done quite a lot in the loan space and also in the private equity, venture, and even bonds. So we are one of the few climate funds that is able to work across public, private, and civil society and using all the financial instruments. Now, being the largest, we are also called to have more coherence and complementarity with other climate funds. If we look at the entire ecosystem of climate funds, one could say that it's somewhat fragmented. We do have many small funds with very small mandates. Having said this, I think there are a few of these funds, one of them being GCF, the largest, that we are also working closely with the GEF, the Global Environmental Facility, that has indeed a climate and a biodiversity angle. We also work closely with the Adaptation Fund, which has indeed a very much a focus in resiliency. We also work with the World Bank housed climate investment funds. They've done a lot in the just transition, on the energy transition. And it is likely that if COP28 brings about a loss and damage fund, we'll be working closely with them. And the idea is that we, among all of these vertical funds, as well as the multilateral development agencies that have indeed important pockets of climate finance, we all work together. So climate finance is indeed on how to come together, how to crowd in more public and private capital in order to move the billions to trillions, which is the big mandate. And we are far from it, but I think the direction is in the right sense, and we hope that we as the GCF play a true catalytic role in that climate finance ecosystem.
Thank you, Henry. So obviously GCF is unique in that it's the largest, and you also talked about its ability to be cross-sectoral across private, public, and civil society as well. I'm going to push you shortly on the complementarity with other funds that exist out there. But for the moment, I'd just like to go back to basics about how this works in practice. What is the project portfolio value and how is the GCF funded?
Thank you. So I'm going to talk about first on how we are funded in order to provide a little bit of a backdrop. So as part of the COP meeting where GCF was created in Cancun, it was agreed that GCF will be receiving contributions from mostly developed countries, but it's also open to other developing countries as well. But the bulk will be coming from large developed countries, and that will become what we call our commitment authority. And with that commitment authority, we will be able to operate and program with a focus of programming in the developing country. So this is one of these mechanisms where developed countries are trying to play their role, and us supporting developing countries who in many cases had zero influence in the climate change they are facing, and their vulnerability has increased because of that mismatch of how climate change occurred. But that's how we are funded. So far, we've had three cycles of replenishment. The first, which is called the Initial Resource Mobilization, IRM, that was the first cycle from 2015 to 2019. And Australia was one of the top 10 contributors in that initial round. And Australia played a very important role in that ramp-up phase by also co-chairing the board of the Green Climate Fund. And that was indeed an opportunity where the Pacific Islands and a lot of those important aspects for Australia's policy was also at the core of how we were working. The second effort, it's called the GCF1, which is our, let's say, second exercise of replenishment in our, let's say, post-initial phase. And that is from 2020 to 2023. So we are finishing that one. In that one, Australia was not a member of the contributors, but we kept working closely with some of the matters and topics that were core to Australia. And we are now launching our next replenishment cycle. We actually just had a replenishment conference in Bonn where we had 25 countries come forward with concrete pledges and 5 countries expressing that they will be coming soon. So we're going to have at least 30 countries. And we were very pleased to announce that Australia is coming back as a contributor to the GCF. With a modest contribution, but with the idea of re-engaging and working closely on the areas that GCF wants to focus in the next programming cycle from 24 to 2027. If we look at how much we've been able to raise in those cycles of replenishment, it is close to around $28 to $30 billion if we were to take those. So the first one was $8 billion American dollars. The second one is $10 billion American dollars. And the current one could get us to hopefully somewhere between 10 and 12. We are finalizing because there will be some potential pledges being announced at COP28 and others before year end. So we hope that we will start 2024 with clarity on our replenishment, but our replenishment are indeed coming forward with a higher number than the previous one. So those countries mostly provide this as grants. In some cases, they could also provide up to a certain amount in loans to the GCF. And then the GCF uses that to cover our operational expenses, but most of it is indeed for programming. Up to today, we have programmed $13.5 billion across 243 projects in 129 countries. And when we look at mitigation and adaptation, we are trying to go to that 50-50 in a grant equivalency, and we are close to that. I think now we close at 51% adaptation, grant equivalent, and 49% mitigation. But the idea is that we're going to get to that 50-50. When we talk about nominal terms, it is more 60% in mitigation and 40% in adaptation in nominal terms. But our KPI is on grant equivalency, which is a way that a lot of countries look at their official development assistance. So the Secretariat was created, and we are headquartered in the Republic of Korea in Incheon, Seongdo. And here we have a technical independent secretariat with almost 300 people. And we are trying to serve all the developing countries from here. However, the board is having discussions of the possibility of having regional presence. So we could be a lot closer. But our business model is one of partnerships. And the way we partner is that we have delivery partners or executing partners that are the ones doing the programming on our behalf. And I'm very pleased to know that WWF is one of those partners with whom we are able to program. And we've been working in many different projects. We also have others based in Australia, like Save the Children Australia, who is another important partner. We've got some partners in the Pacific, like the Fiji Development Bank, SPC, SPREP. So we have many partners with whom we work. We also have commercial banks like Macquarie, who is also a partner on the private sector side. And I'm just mentioning some of those that are either linked to Australia or to the Pacific, but we do have 118 partners that we have accredited to do the programming. So while we are headquartered in Korea, and hopefully we would have some regional presence, our partners are in the field. And our partners are really trying to be the ones that bring some of these important projects for us to meet our mission. Now, another important element is that we follow a country-driven approach. What we mean by country-driven is that our projects need to be aligned with the country's ambitions as stipulated in their NDCs, their National Determined Contributions, which, as you know, is the agreement that was reached at COP21 in Paris, and that now at COP28, we're going to be doing the global stock-taking effort and exercise. So all our projects, when we work through our intermediaries, which are called accredited entities, we work with the government to make sure that they see the alignment. So this is, I would say, one of those important elements of a multilateral fund that has a country-driven approach. And that for us, it is extremely important because we're very close to not just the government of those countries, but also civil society and those people that are facing the vulnerabilities that hopefully with our funds we're able to tackle and hopefully improve. So these entities present funding proposals with the approval of the country. And then the GCF does the thorough appraisal and due diligence of the project. And if they are ripe, we present them to the board for their approval. Prior to going to the board and after it has the approval of the secretariat, they are also looked by an external panel of experts. And then the secretariat looks at the portfolio and makes the approval. And one that is approved, we go into the implementation and execution side. We are able to approve somewhere between 2 to 3 billion a year. That is our capacity. We do have about 3 to 4 board meetings a year. In each board, we sometimes could bring portfolios of 500 to 700, depending on where we are with the pipeline. But that is how we receive the money from the contributors. Then we created our own system and we deployed the money through our accredited entities and hopefully with as much engagement with the local communities and with those countries and regions that are benefiting from where we are. The last important element is that while we've been able to allocate 13.5 billion in approved projects, if we take into account potential co-financing, because our catalyst capital is bringing in more capital, this 13.5 billion will accumulate to over $50 billion with co-financing, making us quite, I would say, a large player in the climate finance. But we're not yet in the 100 billion a year that has been expected by the UNFCCC. And then in every COP, there is a lot of that. But GCF, possibly while we provide a year around 3 billion, we provide truly catalytic capital that hopefully could crowd in a lot more and hopefully reach that 100 billion a year mark that everyone is expecting from us.
Thank you, Henry, for that explanation. That's a really comprehensive view of the work that the GCF do. You've covered quite a few areas that I think we'd like to explore. Perhaps we can come back to Australia's back at the table. We'd love to talk a little bit more about that catalytic role with private finance. But the bit I want to dive a little bit more is you mentioned Pacific a number of times. We're recording this just after the Pacific Island Forum in the Cook Islands, where climate change was a big issue, both mitigation and adaptation. I wonder if you could talk through a little bit of the GCF's approach to the Pacific. You know, you talked about working in partnership on country agendas. How have you partnered in the Pacific and what are the type of projects that you see are going to be critically important going into the future?
Thank you, Dermot. Indeed, our executive director enjoyed her meeting in the Cook Islands. And we've been very privileged to count Prime Minister Brown as one of our champions as we were doing our replenishment this year. So the Pacific, I believe, is, and the overall small island development states are at the core of the dimensions of vulnerability. And indeed, we want to work, and we also want to work better in the Pacific. GCF has several windows, and I think this is important that I would maybe unpack. We have one window, which is on the policy de-risking and enabling environment that we call our readiness grants. And our readiness grants is each country has access to up to $1 million a year in order for them to use that for their national adaptation planning, for their NDCs, for increase the viability of funding proposals. You know, they choose where they have gaps and how hopefully that would help bridge some of the capability or capacity gaps that we have. So I am very pleased to let you know that through readiness, we have covered all the Pacific Islands. We've been able to program readiness grants across all the Pacific Islands. And we were very pleased to see from Australia a research by the Lowry Institute that puts GCF as one of the top five contributors in climate finance in the Pacific Islands. We, on the funding proposal side, we have been able to program over $500 million, which for being a multilateral fund of only 8 years old, it's not such a bad track record. Now, what are some of the challenges and how can we address those challenges? A lot of the challenges and sometimes complaints, and let me tell you that it was great for us to visit the Pacific Islands this year. Several of our teams have been in Samoa, in Fiji, now in Cook Islands, and we will remain engaged because, as you know, given COVID, we had to stop our missions and our visits. There's always this ask about how could you improve access? How could you make access a lot easier for us Pacific Islands? And I believe that message has really hit ground here at the GCF, because the issue that we face is that we were created with a one-size-fits-all model. We were created with an appraisal and a due diligence process that was the same for a private equity, a private sector fund, or for a loan, or for a grant, or for an NGO, or for a region, or for a middle-income country, or for a low-income country. And we have to now, especially as with our new programming, we have put forward very ambitious goals and KPIs. We now need to move from one-size-fits-all to fit-for-purpose. And fit-for-purpose is something that when we work with small island development states, we need to take into account. We need to take into account that we need to provide and build in local capacities that stay in those regions. Sometimes there's been criticism that a lot of this is consultants going from the global north to the global south and very little stays in the global south. We are trying to work to see how we are able to indeed leave some of those capabilities and capacity building at that level. Another way is programming through multi-country or multi-region. Given the size of Pacific Islands, and given the realities, sometimes maybe following a programmatic approach where we could work with 5 or 6 or 8 or 3 countries that will be able to still keep some of the local realities, but maybe bundle some of those costs that if we do individual transactions would make it very expensive. This is an opportunity for us to be able to do that. Engaging private sector. Private sector is key in order for us to be able to crowd in those trillions that I was mentioning. How can we do that in countries or islands, in the case of the Pacific Islands, where maybe the base is low and you need to help build that? So we are trying to provide different tools. We're trying to adjust. Our executive director, who landed today from the Cook Islands after staying for a few extra days doing some site visits to some of our projects, came across and she said, we do need to have efficient, systemic procedures that are somehow responding to the unique realities of the Pacific Islands. They could also most likely support other small island development states. So this is a little bit where we are. So I think the track record is there. We've been able to engage. We have a few partners. We could also increase the number of local partners. That's what we call direct access. A direct access is an entity that is based in the region. An international access is a global entity. Like WWF is a global direct international access entity. Fiji Development Bank is indeed a direct access entity. So how could we also expand the direct access entity offering in order for us to be able to have more partners who know the local original realities and be able to program more and keep them at the core? So this is an important element where we hope we will go to the next PIF in 2024 and where we'll be able to present our progress on efficiency, simplicity, access, and also expand our network of partners in the Pacific Islands. To end, one of the exciting, and I was very privileged to be in Canberra last February, and I want to thank ACFID for hosting that very engaging session that we had with a lot of your constituencies there. But I had several meetings at the parliament and with some other officials. And what I made across was, with Australia on the board of GCF, we will be able to together get programming in the Pacific better. Because this is not a dichotomy between multilateralism and bilateralism. This is indeed collective action at its best. And Australia understands the Pacific, has partners that work closely with the Pacific, and this would be a great opportunity for us to program better, smarter, and more impactful in the Pacific Islands.
Thank you so much, Henry. And I think this issue of access is going to be one that's of real interest to our listeners. Can I drill a little bit more into the balance that you have to strike there? So some of the feedback we've heard from Pacific cohorts and partners is that the funding can be quite slow to trickle down. So you've gone through some of the challenges to the funding. I just wanted to ask, how do you balance following country-driven approaches? So where you're working through a national development plan, for example. You mentioned that there's different windows where people can access funds and that you work through these delivery partners like direct access entities. What's the solution to that expediency? I know you're working on it for PIF 2024, but how do we balance the need to be country-led and going through the right systems and processes through your board and making sure that the experts are able to review the funding proposals with that speed? So if someone in Vanuatu is saying, we've been waiting, we're in a community, it's been 2 years, we haven't seen it on the ground yet, how do you balance that?
Great question. And this is now top of mind to all of us. And I think after seeing that important announcement between Australia and Vanuatu, which somehow hit home saying, oh my God, people have to plan for that already. For me, at least, it shook me to the ground. And we would indeed put all our efforts. You know, organizations that grow organically sometimes self-inflict certain processes that might not be needed once growth is there. And I believe this is the case of the Green Climate Fund. I believe, you know, organically we created a way of appraising. We somehow created a very thorough way of assessing. We have, the board has approved a lot of policies to make sure that we are observing, you know, environmental safeguards, indigenous communities, gender balance. I mean, a lot of those things. But I think now we have reached an important sort of juncture in our growth that maybe is the moment to say, all right, we have now 300 people. We've got 118 partners that we are programming. We are also working with many other readiness partners. Maybe we could somehow expedite some of these procedures. Maybe we could also request the board to allow us to manage some of these windows at the secretariat level with a lot more flexibility, so we could have a rolling basis way of approving. So this is the case of readiness. Readiness at the moment is approved by the board for the full year, for the full 4 years. And then it is us who will be making those decisions on the project by project basis. We have another window that I think is going to help us a lot on the access, Jessica, which is project preparation facility. Given that we have created some of these policies, it is sometimes somewhat burdening to comply with the ESG standards or some of those standards, right? And here, what we would like to do is we would like to have this project preparation facility where entities could access up to $1.5 million, depending on the size of their program or project, to be able to be supported, not only to comply with the GCF, but also to live their own capabilities on how they should be making some of those baseline indicators that hopefully could help other contributors or donors see their incremental improvements in their capacity. This is managed by us. We might be putting forward at some point in the future, if the opportunity were to present itself, whether, you know, low-risk projects of X size might also be approved by us. And in the case of the Pacific Islands, a lot of the projects are small, but we only have 3 boards a year. So we can only organize the approvals alongside those board cycles. So this is another conversation that once we prove to the board that we've been able to really streamline all our internal procedures and that we've been able to do a bit of tailor-made, fit for purpose, what other actions could we do with their approval to get us there? So, but we still first need to do our own exercise. And this is something that we have already embarked. We are embarking on this to improve accreditation. We are currently launching a pilot of project-based accreditation, where we do not have to do the big 4-year waiting to accredit one entity, but we would just do one project cycle where we hopefully accredit an entity for that specific project. And this would allow us to bring entities in areas where we have gaps. We will be bringing by the end of 2024 a new accreditation strategy to the board. And in the last board meeting that took place in Georgia, the board allowed for us to extend the accreditation of our partners while we build that new strategy, so our partners don't need to lapse or go through a very lengthy reaccreditation. So that is where we are. We were very, very pleased that in the last board meeting, we accredited the Federated States of Micronesia Development Bank as one new entity for the Pacific Islands. And now we've got 6 entities in the Pacific Islands accredited at the GCF. We are hoping to bring more, as I said. Now, the other important element is programming that could serve the entire Pacific Island ecosystem. And one area that we are working very closely is in the early warning systems. This is needed across. We are currently trying to work with the UN as part of the early warning systems for all. And we're hoping to be working with over 60 countries worldwide. Among them, we will be having a lot of work in the Pacific Islands. So we are, let's say, the job is cut out for us. I think having gone to the PIF, this is the first time that we have our senior, our executive director attending, make us more accountable and engaging with you as well and your listeners today, make us more accountable that we do need to move away from one size fits all and truly try to see how we deliver this funding that is extremely needed in those regions or areas where vulnerability is at the core and we need to make them more resilient.
Henry, that's great to hear because I was also at the Pacific Island Forum last week. The Pacific Island leaders really value partners coming to listen firsthand and really engage in their strategy for the blue Pacific continent strategy around how they're going to manage the threats of climate change and also mitigation. Can we revert to Australia's back at the table? That's an important message from the Australian government that it's wanting to engage with the GCF more. You talked about this, how do we get to $100 billion? Can you talk a little bit about, you know, Australia's role and the ambition to really bring that capital to the places that need it most in tackling climate change?
So as I mentioned, Australia was one of our top contributors in the early phase of the GCF. They truly invested in creating us as a solid institution to serve those that needed the most. They served on the board and they chaired the board or co-chaired the board into the right direction of getting the policies in place. And I believe Australia in the recent year or so has truly announced this shift around climate policy and new climate commitments. And we are hopefully seeing this with the GCF as well. You know, at the local level, there's been that climate bill that has launched those new targets on cutting emissions by 2030, at least at 43%. That's a good signal. This is a good way of making the agenda very clear at the domestic level. It's also been important that Australia has looked at their official development assistance and hoping to increase at the Pacific region. And they resume annual increases, or they will be resuming annual increase in ODA from 2026 onwards, which is a good indication given the realities of the macroeconomy. I also think that Australia's current leadership as a member of the Transitional Committee for Loss and Damage is a good signal because loss and damage, as you know, it is a very important element for COP28. And while GCF has worked across the minimizing and averting loss and damage, we don't have the setup for the addressing, for that immediate deployment of capital because of how we go through our approvals. But it is great to know that Australia has been taking that leadership. And lastly, Australia has also confirmed that they want to double the climate finance to $2 billion Australian dollars for 2023-2025 period. And the Pacific Islands is getting at least around 700 million of this funding, right? So we do see a re-engaging and we do see a focus on domestic and international policies around climate. When we heard the news by Minister Wong that Australia was rejoining the GCF and will be making a modest contribution by the end of the year, we applauded that. And we, by the way, when we do a replenishment, we don't close it. We leave it open. So if it is a modest initial contribution, we hope that we will be able to convince them that we're doing the right thing and more contributions could come throughout the next 4 years where we're doing this programming between 2024 and 2027. And as I said, because it's not just the resources that matter, it is also the voice on the board. It is also the knowledge that Australia has in climate finance. It is also the Australian partners that we will be able to tap, both at the government or non-government level. So a country represents more than its coffers when they join the GCF. They are also helping us build a better multilateral institution. And given the realities and the crisis that we all are facing, we really need to reimagine multilateralism. And I think in the climate finance space, this is a great opportunity. So I'm extremely hopeful for welcoming Australia to our board and working with Australia to the GCF. And I also remain quite engaged on working together on vulnerability, which is one of our key areas in our next programming. Could countries do better? Of course, country can always do better. But sometimes we need to understand that the competing priorities are sometimes difficult for decision making. But one thing that everyone, I believe, or at least countries like Australia, have realized is that climate and development are intertwined. They're not a zero sum. They're not independent. They are interdependent. And this is an opportunity for us to be able to reach the SDGs while protecting people and planet together with climate. So I'm very hopeful for this returning of Australia as a key member to the GCF.
Thank you, Henry. Can I go back to a stat that you used earlier in our conversation, where I think you talked a little around $3.5 billion had mobilized more than $50 billion of co-financing. You talked a little bit about that catalytic role, the increasing role of the private sector. And I think increasing the private sector is realizing that they play a critical role in climate and development and financing solutions there. Can you talk a little bit about where you see the opportunities from the climate, you know, from the climate financing for private sector to come in and really go beyond 100 billion and really mobilize trillions of dollars to solve the climate challenge?
Thank you, Dermot. So just to paraphrase, GCF has committed $13.5 billion as of the last board meeting that was held in Tbilisi, Georgia, in last month. Indeed, that $13.5 billion, if we take into account expected co-financing. So this co-financing is hopefully will come as projects mature. We would be counting for over $50 billion on that. That is, for us, not a bad track record because we've done that in 8 years. But when we realize that the need, as I said, is in the trillions on a yearly basis, and at COP, there's been expectations to at least reach 100 billion a year of climate mobilization, we are far from it. Now, one thing that we'd like to clarify, because sometimes it has become misunderstood, the 100 billion, it is global climate finance mobilization. It was never GCF mobilization only as GCF. It is globally. Now, our new executive director, Mafalda Duarte, took advantage of the United Nations General Assembly. And in the Climate Ambition Summit, she unveiled her vision. And Mafalda's vision is 50 by 30. And the 50 by 30 means that we hope the GCF will be managing $50 billion efficiently and impactfully by 2030. 2030 is only 6 years away, right? So this is a lot of work and is a phenomenal vision because we would really like to use our unparalleled unique features that we have the flexibility to use any financial instrument, that we work across mitigation and adaptation equally, that we have a high risk appetite, and that we are going to be able to bring all of those partners. Now, to reach that, we also need to harness these assets to hopefully target and reach the most vulnerable. As I mentioned before, this is key. But also going to your point, Dermot, ensure that we are maximizing the private sector investments. And here, this is where we use our finite public capital as a catalytic instrument to crowd in private sector capital. And a lot of times, we need to first provide that first loss in order for the private sector to be able to somehow manage the risk, because they do have fiduciary responsibilities, either to their pensioners or to their savers or to their institutional investors. So what we say to them is, let's come together. We can take that, let's say, higher risk cushion, but then you can mobilize more capital. So that's exactly how we did our engagement with Macquarie Bank in Australia. So Macquarie Asset Management is the entity accredited by the Macquarie Group at the Green Climate Fund. They had a very, I would say, market transformational project on e-mobility in India, where they would like to provide funding to indeed shift the three-wheelers and some of the vehicles into electric vehicles. But then they realized that they were lacking a market, a financial market for leasing. And in order to be efficient in providing those investments, we needed a leasing market. So they came to GCF and we created a company that together will be providing groundbreaking leasing investments so people could finance their electric vehicles, hopefully reaching the most vulnerable or those at the bottom of the pyramid. So this is just an example where we provided, let's say, $205 million of our own capital. Macquarie provided another $205 at the equity level, just like us, but hopefully they will be able to leverage over $1.2 billion through their different debt or other facilities. So this is one where with 200 of the GCF, we might be reaching over $1 billion. So this is the catalytic impact that we would like to do. And we believe that GCF is the right partner, the right catalytic partner of blended finance. Because indeed, climate finance requires this special blending between public and private. Now, we need to make sure that we choose the right transactions that are market creator or that are providing a paradigm shift, because we don't want to subsidize or distort markets that are not needed. So this is where we are always looking at our level of concessionality linked to our additionality. What are we adding to the market? Is this a proof of concept? And then the moment we're no longer needed, I mean, getting us out of business is a success story, because then the private sector can do it on their own. So that is some of the elements of how do we engage with the private sector.
I think we could have an entire podcast on how you calculate additionality and making sure that you're getting those calculations right, Henry. I really want to dive deeper with you. But I think what you're doing there is you're really answering that question of how we move from billions to trillions, acknowledging that countries can do better always as well. It's not only on the private sector to come to the table. So, Henry, I get really excited when we start talking about actual programs. And the example you just gave in India was really great for me to hear, because we can mobilize this funding, but for what? What are the programs it's translating to? So I would like to ask you, what is the GCF doing to promote green development pathways in the Pacific? Can you give us some examples and talk through that, please?
So the green development pathways are, as you know, a new approach to growth, a new approach to development. And here, I think we can take stock that we don't need to follow the other models that have already been exhausted and they were fossil fuel driven. That here we will be able to explore projects that are going to be exploring, you know, other ways. So we are working around, for example, the use of green hydrogen. And this is things in our pipeline, all right? And it's for the Pacific or also for the rest of the small island development states. But that is, how could we use green hydrogen as an opportunity for us to use cleaner technologies, but also in some of the islands, there's no 24/7 access to electricity for different reasons. How could we find, let's say, a smarter solution that will get us there? Same thing on mobility. On mobility. How could we somehow be able to create solutions that provide a better use of different technologies in regards to mobility? We're also working on the area of green growth from a what we call blue co-financing platforms, where we're looking at the blue economy in a different way. Meaning, you know, some of the islands depend on ecotourism. Some of the islands have reef to protect. How do we make sure that while we increase tourism, reef is protected? We created a private sector fund for coral reef that will be covering some of the Pacific Island states. So it is indeed this sort of shift of mindset that let us reset the button of development in a way that does not have to, or that embeds the learnings of how the classical fossil fuel system was done. Now, we also are engaging, and this is something that we're doing with Save the Children Australia. We're also trying to work with locally led solutions, especially on the adaptation. We do believe in indigenous knowledge. We do believe in the importance of locally led solutions for those that are the most vulnerable. So we're working. And I think that in some of those projects that we are already launching, we might be able to bring lessons learned to other Pacific Islands and expand the project or the program. So we are really, really working a lot on that. We're also trying to work in areas around water, water reuse. This is something that we actually just did in the Caribbean, that I also believe we could have cross-fertilization of things we do in some regions of the SIDS and other regions. So those are some of the elements where it's a really new thinking of how we can get. Now, the best about this, Jessica, is that these ideas come from these regions. They have the solutions. So it's not top down, it's actually bottom up. And that's why for us, the country drivenness makes so much sense. Agreed. Because they have already thought through this, they have already done programming. Now, we wish, and I think this is an area for us to improve, where we have country programs, but sometimes those country programs do not have a clear, viable pipeline of projects. And we would like to somehow enhance the policy baseline into actual co-originating or co-creation of investment platforms that would have green pathways at the core. Green and blue pathways at the core, if you will.
Henry, that's I think, a good place to start to wrap up. And I'm excited about the opportunities to rethink the economy, the blue and green economy. I think in some of the big island states are great places to innovate from the bottom up and to show how things can be done differently to tackle the climate crisis and decouple us from fossil fuels. So thank you once again, Henry, for, I think, a fabulous conversation and the work of the Green Climate Fund. Potentially in 2026, Pacific and Australia might be hosting COP31. So by that stage, I hope we're talking about the hundreds of billions of dollars being mobilised that is needed. But I just wanted to wrap up and say thank you so much. My name is Dermot O'Gorman, and Jessa McKenzie and I hope you've enjoyed the conversation around a little less conversation. Thank you, and see you next time.
Thank you.